Chapter 93. It was one of those March days, when the sun shines hot, and the wind blows cold. When it is summer in the light, and winter in the shade. We had out pea coats with us, and I took a bag. Of all my worldly possessions I took, no more than the few necessaries, that filled the bag. Where I might go, what I might do, or when I might return, were questions utterly unknown to me, nor did I vex my mind with them, for it was wholly set on Provis's safety. I only wondered for the passing moment, as I stopped at the door and looked back, under what altered circumstances I should next see those rooms, if ever. We loitered down to the temple stairs, and stood loitering there, as if we were not quite decided to go upon the water at all. Of course I had taken care that the boat should be ready, and everything in order. After a little show of indecision, which there were none to see, but the two or three amphibious creatures belonging to our temple stairs, we went on board and cast off, Herbert in the bow, I steering. It was then about high water 8:30. Our plan was this. The tide, beginning to run down at 9, and being with us until 3, we intended still to creep on after it had turned, and row against it until dark. We should then be well in those long reaches below Gravesend, between Kent and Essex, where the river is broad and solitary, where the waterside inhabitants are very few, and where lone public houses are scattered here and there, of which we could choose one for a resting place. There, we meant to lie by, all night. The steamer for Hamburg, and the steamer for Rotterdam, would start from London at about 9 on Thursday morning. We should know at what time to expect them, according to where we were, and would hail the first, so that if by any accident we were not taken abroad, we should have another chance. We knew the distinguishing marks of each vessel. The relief of being at last engaged in the execution of the purpose was so great to me that I felt it difficult to realize the condition in which I had been a few hours before. The crisp air, the sunlight, the movement on the river, and the moving river itself, the road that ran with us, seeming to sympathize with us, animate us, and encourage us, on freshened me with new hope. I felt mortified to be of so little use in the boat, but there were few better oarsmen than my two friends, and they rowed with a steady stroke that was to last all day. At that time, the steam traffic on the Thames was far below its present extent, and watermen's boats were far more numerous. Of barges, sailing colliers, and coasting traders, there were perhaps as many as now, but of steamships, great and small, not a tithe or a twentieth part so many. Early as it was, there were plenty of scullers going here and there that morning, and plenty of barges dropping down with the tide. The navigation of the river between bridges, in an open boat, was a much easier and commoner matter in those days than it is in these, and we went ahead among many skiffs and wherries, briskly. Old London Bridge was soon passed, and Old Billingsgate Market with its oyster boats and Dutchmen, and the White Tower and Traitor's Gate, and we were in among the tiers of shipping. Here were the Leith, Aberdeen, and Glasgow steamers, loading and unloading goods, and looking immensely high out of the water as we passed alongside. Here were colliers by the score and score, with the coal whippers plunging off stages on deck, as counterweights to measures of coal swinging up, which were then rattled over the side in two barges. Here, at her moorings, was tomorrow's steamer for Rotterdam, of which we took good notice, and here tomorrow's for Hamburg, under whose bowsprit we crossed. And now I, sitting in the stern, could see with a faster beating heart Mill Pond Bank and Mill Pond Stairs. "Is he there?" said Herbert. "Not yet." "Right. He was not to come down till he saw us. Can you see his signal?" "Not well from here, but I think I see it. Now, I see him. Pull both. Easy, Herbert. Oars." We touched the stairs lightly for a single moment, and he was on board, and we were off again. He had a boat cloak with him, and a black canvas bag, and he looked as like a river pilot as my heart could have wished. "Dear boy," he said, putting his arm on my shoulder as he took his seat. faithful dear boy, well done. Thank you, thank you. Again among the tiers of shipping, in and out, avoiding rusty chain cables, frayed hempen hawsers and bobbing buoys, sinking for the moment floating broken baskets, scattering floating chips of wood and shaving, cleaving floating scum of coal, in and out, under the figurehead of the John of Sunderland making a speech to the winds, as is done by many Johns, and the Betsy of Yarmouth with a firm formality of bosom and her knobby eye starting 2 inches out of her head, in and out, hammers going in shipbuilders' yards, saws going at timber, clashing engines going at things unknown, pumps going in leaky ships, capstans going, ships going out to sea, and unintelligible sea creatures roaring curses over the bulwarks at respondent lightermen, in and out, out at last upon the clear river, where the ship's boys might take their fenders in, no longer fishing in troubled waters with them over the side, and where the festooned sails might fly out to the wind. At the stairs where we had taken them abroad, and ever since, I had looked warily for any token of our being suspected. I had seen none. We certainly had not been, and at that time as certainly we were not, either attended or followed by any boat. If we had been waited on by any boat, I should have run into shore, and have obliged her to go on, or to make her purpose evident. But, we held our own, without any appearance of molestation. He had his boat cloak on him, and looked, as I have said, a natural part of the scene. It was remarkable, but perhaps the wretched life he had led, accounted for it, that he was the least anxious of any of us. He was not indifferent, for he told me, that he hoped to live to see his gentleman one of the best of gentlemen in a foreign country. He was not disposed to be passive or resigned, as I understood it, but he had no notion of meeting danger halfway. When it came upon him, he confronted it, but it must come, before he troubled himself. If you knowed, dear boy, he said to me, what it is to sit here longer, my dear boy, and have my smoke, arter having been day by day betwixt four walls, you'd envy me. But you don't know what it is. I think I know the delights of freedom, I answered. Ah, said he, shaking his head gravely. But you don't know it equal to me. You must have been under lock and key, dear boy, to know it equal to me, but I ain't a going to be low. It occurred to me as inconsistent, that for any mastering idea, he should have endangered his freedom, and even his life. But I reflected that perhaps freedom without danger was too much apart from all the habit of his existence, to be to him what it would be to another man. I was not far out, since he said, after smoking a little. You see, dear boy, when I was over yonder, t'other side the world, I was always a looking to this side, and it come flat to be there, for all I was a growing rich. Everybody knowed Magwitch, and Magwitch could come, and Magwitch could go, and nobody's head would be troubled about him. They ain't so easy concerning me here, dear boy wouldn't be, leastwise, if they knowed where I was. If all goes well, said I, you will be perfectly free and safe again, within a few hours. Well, he returned, drawing a long breath, I hope so. And think so? He dipped his hand in the water over the boat's gunwale, and said, smiling with that softened air upon him which was not new to me. Eh, I suppose I think so, dear boy. We'd be puzzled to be more quiet and easy going than we are at present. But it's a flowing so soft and pleasant through the water, p'raps, as makes me think it, I was a thinking through my smoke just then, that we can no more see to the bottom of the next few hours, than we can see to the bottom of this river, what I catches hold of. Nor yet we can't no more hold there tight than I can hold this. And it's run through my fingers and gone, you see, holding up his dripping hand. But for your face, I should think you were a little despondent, said one. Not a bit on it, dear boy. It comes of flowing on so quiet, and of that there rippling at the boat's head making a sort of a Sunday tune. Maybe I may growing a trifle old besides. He put his pipe back in his mouth with an undisturbed expression of face, and sat as composed and contented, as if we were already out of England. Yet he was as submissive to a word of advice as if he had been in constant terror, for when we ran ashore to get some bottles of beer into the boat and he was stepping out, I hinted that I thought he would be safest where he was, and he said, "Do you, dear boy?" and quietly sat down again. The air felt cold upon the river, but it was a bright day, and the sunshine was very cheering. The tide ran strong, I took care to lose none of it, and our steady stroke carried us on thoroughly well. By imperceptible degrees, as the tide ran out, we lost more and more of the nearer woods and hills, and dropped lower and lower between the muddy banks, but the tide was yet with us when we were off Gravesend. As our charge was wrapped in his cloak, I purposely passed within a boat or two's length of the floating custom house, and so out to catch the stream, alongside of two emigrant ships, and under the bows of a large transport with troops on the forecastle looking down at us. And soon the tide began to slacken, and the craft lying at anchor to swing, and presently they had all swung round, and the ships, that were taking advantage of the new tide, to get up to the pool, began to crowd upon us in a fleet, and we kept under the shore, as much out of the strength of the tide now as we could, standing carefully off from low shallows and mud banks. Our oarsmen were so fresh, by dint of having occasionally let her drive with the tide for a minute or two, that a quarter of an hour's rest proved full as much as they wanted. We got ashore among some slippery stones, while we ate and drank what we had with us, and looked about. It was like my own marsh country, flat and monotonous, and with a dim horizon, while the winding river turned and turned, and the great floating buoys upon it turned and turned, and everything else seemed stranded and still. For now, the last of the fleet of ships was round the last low point we had headed, and the last green barge, straw-laden, with a brown sail, had followed, and some ballast lighters, shaped like a child's first rude imitation of a boat, lay low in the mud. And a little squat shoal lighthouse on open piles, stood crippled in the mud on stilts and crutches, and slimy stakes stuck out of the mud, and slimy stones stuck out of the mud, and red landmarks and tide marks stuck out of the mud, and an old landing stage and an old roofless building slipped into the mud, and all about us was stagnation and mud. We pushed off again, and made what way we could. It was much harder work now, but Herbert and Startop persevered, and rowed, and rowed, and rowed, until the sun went down. By that time the river had lifted us a little, so that we could see above the bank. There was the red sun, on the low level of the shore, in a purple haze, fast deepening into black, and there was the solitary flat marsh. And far away there were the rising grounds, between which and us there seemed to be no life, save here and there in the foreground a melancholy gull. As the night was fast falling, and as the moon, being past the full, would not rise early, we held a little council. A short one, for clearly our course was to lie by at the first lonely tavern we could find. So, they plied their oars once more, and I looked out for anything like a house. Thus we held on, speaking little, for 4 or 5 dull miles. It was very cold, and a collier coming by us, with her galley fire smoking and flaring, looked like a comfortable home. The night was as dark by this time as it would be until morning, and what light we had seemed to come more from the river than the sky, as the oars in their dipping struck at a few reflected stars. At this dismal time we were evidently all possessed by the idea that we were followed. As the tide made, it flapped heavily at irregular intervals against the shore, and whenever such a sound came, one or other of us was sure to start and look in that direction. Here and there, the set of the current had worn down the bank into a little creek, and we were all suspicious of such places, and eyed them nervously. Sometimes, "What was that ripple?" one of us would say in a low voice. Or another, "Is that a boat yonder?" And afterwards, we would fall into a dead silence, and I would sit impatiently thinking with what an unusual amount of noise the oars worked in the thowels. At length we descried a light and a roof, and presently afterwards ran alongside a little causeway made of stones that had been picked up hard by. Leaving the rest in the boat, I stepped ashore and found the light to be in a window of a public house. It was a dirty place enough, and I dare say not unknown to smuggling adventurers. But there was a good fire in the kitchen, and there were eggs and bacon to eat, and various liquors to drink. Also, there were two double-bedded rooms such as they were, the landlord said. No other company was in the house than the landlord, his wife, and a grizzled male creature, the Jack of the Little Causeway, who was as slimy and smeary as if he had been low water mark too. With this assistant, I went down to the boat again, and we all came ashore, and brought out the oars, and rudder, and boat hook, and all else, and hauled her up for the night. We made a very good meal by the kitchen fire, and then apportioned the bedrooms. Herbert and Startop were to occupy one, I and our charge the other. We found the air as carefully excluded from both, as if air were fatal to life, and there were more dirty clothes and bandboxes under the beds than I should have thought the family possessed. But we considered ourselves well off, notwithstanding, for a more solitary place we could not have found. While we were comforting ourselves by the fire after our meal, the Jack who was sitting in a corner, and who had a bloated pair of shoes on, which he had exhibited, while we were eating our eggs and bacon, as interesting relics, that he had taken a few days ago from the feet of a drowned seaman washed ashore, asked me if we had seen a four-oared galley going up with the tide. When I told him no, he said she must have gone down then, and yet she took up too, when she left there. They must ha thought better on't for some reason or another, said the Jack, and gone down. A four-oared galley, did you say? Said one. A four, said the Jack, and two sitters. Did they come ashore here? They put in with a stone 2-gallon jar, for some beer. I'd have been glad to poison the beer myself, said the Jack, or put some rattling physic in it. Why? I know why, said the Jack. He spoke in a slushy voice, as if much mud had washed into his throat. He thinks, said the landlord. A weakly meditative man with a pale eye, who seemed to rely greatly on his Jack. He thinks they was. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.